right, folks, you are listening to Yishai Fleischer on Galei Yisrael. Hour number two has begun. And as I said before, I am completely and utterly psyched to be here broadcasting in English on Israeli airwaves, the only show in English broadcasting on regular radio here. And we are broadcasting throughout the whole country from Jerusalem, as we said before, Ki Mitzion Tetzeh Torah. From Zion shall come forth teaching and Torah. That's pretty cool. And I'm glad to be part of it. And of course, if you do want to email me, get in touch with me, it's yishai@yishaifleischer.com. Yishai, Y-I-S-H-A-I. And we're going to get out to the whole world because we got a message that the world needs to hear. All right, so we talked about Benjamin Netanyahu's speech a little bit in the last hour, and I think we got to get back to the topic because it's very important. And I, you know, there's no question about it that we love to be proud of our prime minister, and it's a rare thing. We don't get a chance to be so proud of our prime minister so often. So it's really great when that does happen. And you know, there were moments that I was very proud, but there were some things that drove me so crazy that make me feel so weak and disempowered that can just make you nuts. And I wanted to explain to you why, you know, Yishai Fleischer, a person who loves Israel, who wants to love his prime minister, who wants to, you know, stand up and applaud like so many American congressmen, just felt at some points frustrated. And I think it's important for you to get a sense of you know, what's really happening underneath. What are the conflicts? So let's take a listen to one of the most important parts of the Netanyahu speech at Congress.
The peace agreements between Israel and Egypt and Israel and Jordan are vital, but they're not enough. We must also find a way to forge a lasting peace with the Palestinians.
So they clearly like that, right? They clearly got excited about
2 years ago, I publicly committed to a solution of two states for two peoples, a Palestinian state alongside a Jewish state. I'm willing to make painful compromises to achieve this historic peace. As the leader of Israel, it's my responsibility to lead my people to peace. Now, this is not easy for me. It's not easy. Because I recognize that in a genuine peace, we'll be required to give up parts of the ancestral Jewish homeland. And you have to understand this.
So just want to make it clear, in a genuine peace, right? A genuine peace, we're going to have to give up parts of our homeland. The genuine peace is going to be that somehow there's going to have to be an Arab country on historic Jewish homeland. That's the only genuine thing. It sounds to me disingenuous. It sounds like it doesn't make any sense that somehow we're going to cut away parts of our genuine homeland, give away our genuine history to people who don't have a genuine history in this land, who may have a genuine claim to be living here, to have a right to live here, but not a right to sovereignty. And yet somehow this genuine peace is his responsibility. It's his responsibility to give away parts of our land. It's his responsibility to somehow, quote unquote, bring peace when we know time and time again that this whole attitude, that this whole way of thinking has only brought war and continuous lack of peace and destabilization.
In Judea and Samaria, the Jewish people are not foreign occupiers.
So the one phrase that absolutely got them to their feet and went nuts is when he said that Judea and Samaria, the Jews have a rightful inheritance claim. Now, this is not what the Palestinian rhetoric is. I recently saw a video that showed Jews praying at the Kotel, and they basically said at the Western Wall, and they basically said that this was from the Palestinian Media Watch, which captured television from regular Palestinian television, and basically said that the Jewish people's lies, the Jewish people's lies are at root of why these Jewish people are showing up at the Western Wall, and we're somehow undermining real Muslim Islamic history. And so these folks in Congress who know the truth, know that this is not correct, know that the Jewish people have a historical claim and a continuous relationship to the land of Israel that has never been broken. When he said these words, they stood up and said, "That's right. That's truth, Benjamin Netanyahu. You finally did something that a lot of politicians don't have the guts to do, which is just to say truth, which is this is our homeland." And I think this is one of the crowning achievements of Benjamin Netanyahu, that he was able to say, "This is our homeland." And yet in the very same breath that he says this is our homeland, he's talking about his ability to make painful concessions, his ability to cut it away, his ability to let the jihad have a victory on our land, his ability to empower those Muslim, really jihadist leaders who actually are the people who oppress, the leaders that oppress the Muslim nation, the Arab nation. And he wants to empower these people by saying, "Here, we're going to hand you the greatest victory of them all, Israel, this shining light, this thing that could change the whole Middle East to a better place. You will beat it with your rhetoric and your lies." How can both those things coexist at the same time?
We're not the British in India. We're not the Belgians in the Congo. This is the land of our forefathers, the land of Israel, to which Abraham brought the idea of one God, where David set out to confront Goliath, and where Isaiah saw a vision of eternal peace. No distortion of history. And boy, am I reading a lot of distortions of history lately, old and new. No distortion of history could deny the 4,000-year-old bond between the Jewish people and the Jewish land. But there is another truth. The Palestinians share this small land with us. We seek a peace in which they'll be neither Israel's subjects nor its citizens. They should enjoy a national life of dignity as a free, viable, and independent people living in their own state.
Now, let me ask you a question. He said that the Arabs living in our land should somehow have their own sovereignty, their own state, because they need a life of dignity. Do you mean to say that there's no dignity in living under Israeli rule and Israeli law? It's not dignified to be a foreigner and to live in the Jewish state? I think it's extremely dignified to be a welcome guest in the land of Israel. I think it's extremely dignified to be a Muslim living in a Jewish state. Jews lived in Muslim states, and sometimes they felt dignified, other times not. But we take it as a source of pride that other nations can live in our country. Why is it that a nation that somehow has come to this land searching for work, searching for jobs, that have, as the latest that they have come is in the year 637 under the Muslim conquest, which is not exactly something dignified to get rid of other peoples and to take over their lands. But most of the Arabs living in Israel today have come here in the 1850s, searching for Jewish work, labor that was created through Jewish economics here in the land of Israel. And now somehow it's not dignified for them to live in our ancestral homeland. And this is the tricky thing, because Benjamin Netanyahu, on the one hand, has done a great job at starting to roll back the consciousness that we are somehow occupiers. At least he's been able to say that out loud in Congress, and that is certainly an achievement. But at the same time, to undermine yourself, to undermine the very things that you're saying by not hitting it all the way home, by bunting when you should have struck that easy ball, right? You missed the opportunity, and you empowered you continue to let a foreign idea fester. And it reminds me when King Saul destroyed the Amalekites, but he left the king. He left the king. And the king of the Amalekites, Agag, was able to give birth to Haman because you didn't get rid of it. You didn't get rid of the bad idea all the way. So surely Netanyahu succeeded in getting Jewish pride back up and in reminding us that this is our homeland and that we should be proud of this homeland and it's our historical homeland. And at the same time, though, he allowed that idea to fester on. And he even strengthened it by saying that somehow the people living in our land are not living in dignity. It's somehow undignified to live under Israeli sovereignty, to be subjects of Israel. Why is that so bad? Why is that so bad? I think that being a subject of Israel, being a citizen of Israel, being a resident of Israel is way better than being a resident of a lot of other countries who will not give you that respect. Hey, I like the idea of having Arab countries. They want to run their countries. They want to have national pride, self-determination. That is wonderful. I believe in that. I believe in a proud and free Syria. I believe in a proud and free Iran. I believe in a free Iranian people. I support them. I support the revolutions against those horrible tyrants. I support that. But I don't support the takeover of our land by those very despotic forces who want to undermine our sovereignty first in Judea and Samaria, first, of course, in Gaza, then in Judea and Samaria, and then the rest of Israel. That's wrong. And Benjamin Netanyahu, as strong as he was, did not yet have the strength to completely eliminate that way of thinking. And in a sense, he let it live. He gave it another chance to live. And you know what? I'm being highly critical, but I'm not calling him a bad name. I'm not calling him a bad name. I think that he's the leader for our time. It's just that I want more for him. I want him to really say it the way it is. I want him to be loud and proud. I want him to knock it out of the park. I want him to make perfect sense and not to actually walk on both sides of the fence or no side of the fence or somehow try to balance things that aren't balanceable. You cannot believe that Judea and Samaria are the rightful inheritance of the Jewish people and our ancestral homeland and at the same time want to create a Palestinian state which undoubtedly will undermine our sovereignty and will fight for the destruction of the rest of Israel. In terms of international law, the land that was allotted to the Jewish people to create a national home already has two Palestinian states on it because Jordan was supposed to be the land of Israel, a land set aside for the Jewish people. And that became the Hashemite kingdom because the British brought their friends from Saudi Arabia and gave them a plot of land, and they took it away from the Jews. Now Gaza has become a second Palestinian state. I forgot to mention Jordan is, of course, 80% Palestinian. And now Gaza is a Palestinian state. So now we are heading towards a third Palestinian state in Judea and Samaria, and they, of course, want the right of return to make a fourth Palestinian state, four Palestinian states on one Jewish homeland. And don't forget that those four are in addition to 23 other Arab countries who are exactly ethnically the same. Now, again, I do not for one second doubt that Arabs have the right to live in Israel and, in fact, have a right to citizenship as well, as long as they don't act seditiously. But they don't have a right to sovereignty. They never had sovereignty on this land. They never deserved sovereignty on this land. This is a takeover of somebody else's sovereignty, of the Jewish people's true right, and we should not allow it, and we should not allow these ideas to fester. And it's time to sit down, and I've got friends like people like Yoel Meltzer and others who are organizing meetings, events, articles that say something very simple. If we have 125 communities in Judea and Samaria, let's annex them. Let's annex them. That's the next logical step. And there are ways to deal with the Arab population there. There are ways to give them respect and dignity under Israel. And we'll talk about these and more plans in the future. All right, folks, we have for you a very special treat, and that is Knesset member Ari Eldad. He's a great plastic surgeon, a burn specialist, and a Knesset member for Ichud Elohimi. And the reason he's in Knesset and not in just the hospital is because he realized that in order to stop having those burn victims and those terror victims, we got to do something about it from the political level. So Knesset member Ari Eldad, welcome to the Yishai Fleischer Show.
Thank you, Ishai. Shalom. Shalom to you, and congratulations for the new show. It's an important station, an important program, and I hope you'll serve the people of Israel and the land of Israel in this show as you did before.
Thank you very much. It is really a pleasure to be broadcasting in Israel. Just that feeling that you can get your voice out and to the whole country, and to have the right to be living in this era where we have a land of Israel and we have technology and we have medicine, and it feels like messianic times sometimes. It's just something so amazing. People say to me, why do you think we're in Yemot HaMashiach or something like that? Why do you think we're in messianic days? I said, because of antibiotics. It's just so incredible that we have these abilities. So I'm not a doctor like you, but at least I'm a fan of the fact that we're living in this age of healing, and it would be nice if we could get some healing here in the land of Israel as well.
I was 17 when Jerusalem was united, and I went with my late father to tell the Jerusalemite tzaddik, Reb Aryeh Levin, my sandak, to let him know that the old city was liberated. And I remember my father tells him, Rebbe, we can hear the steps of Mashiach, the steps of Messiah. And Reb Aryeh Levin asked, what do you mean the steps? He's already here.
Now, some people could say, you know, they could start listing you a big laundry list of things that aren't working out so well in Israel, and they'll say, you know, Yishai Fleischer and the Knesset member Ari Eldad and these people, they're kooks. They don't see all the problems. And this isn't what we've been waiting for. And that's the whole, you know, argument of Neturei Karta. This isn't it. This is not it. Like, how do you know this is it?
I must embark upon the definition of Messiah by the Rambam, by the Maimonides. Said, He will make wars, and he will win in these wars. And then he will build the third temple. And then we will know that he is the real Messiah. Nobody promised us that we will have no problems in times of him. The other way around, we'll have big problems, but he will be able to solve them.
How does a secular person in Israel or around the world, you know, connect to these things? The movements that you've been involved in, the Lehi and your own political party, which is called Hatikva, which is really there to raise up the flag of secular nationalism. How does a person like that connect to these ideas of a third temple? You know, I've mentioned a lot of ideas to quote-unquote secular Jews, and the one idea that gets them very excited on the whole is a third temple. Some it scares, but a lot it excites. Why is that? How do we bridge that gap?
I don't want to disappoint you, Ishai, but if the secular in Israel would try to run somebody to be a prime minister, they shouldn't take me. I'm not a real secular. I am a believer, so they shouldn't take me as an example of a secular. Even though in many other nations, nobody would ask about a patriot whether he's religious or not. It's almost unique to the Jewish people. If somebody said the land of Israel belonged to the people of Israel according to the Torah, they will look for the kippah on his head.
Right.
I don't wear a kippah, but I still believe that the land of Israel belonged to the people of Israel according to the Torah.
I think that you would make an excellent candidate for them, because many, many people in Israel do believe that. That's the way people feel. The nationalism that you meet at the cab driver level and at the barber level is much higher than the one that you meet even at the Knesset level. Not even the Knesset, the media level. And the media level, that's where it's at the lowest. But at the people level, it's at the highest.
Yes, but the easiest definition or the easiest segmentation of the Jewish people: are you religious or non-religious? Are you secular or religious? And it doesn't work like this for people.
Right. I think we do that sometimes because we're looking for easy ways to define ourselves, and the way we define ourselves is not like other people. And it's a bit infantile, it's a bit childish, and really it also goes against the conception of trying to unite our people and to see the oneness in our people. And that's not always easy. But, you know, in the last hour I talked about that over these the Sfira period, the 50 days from the 49 days up till Shavuot, from the second day of Pesach, I've been privileged to see a lot of mass gatherings of Jews at Meiron, at Yom HaTzmaut, at Yom Yerushalayim, and at Shavuot itself also. All these holidays, I've gotten to see so many Jews. You know what, Dr. Ariel Dad? I've been very moved and very inspired that the Jewish people are moving forward and that we don't have to worry about it. And the best example of that is when you see, you know, some 40,000 kids showing up at the Kotel on Yom Yerushalayim waving the flag. You know, do you see it that way, or am I being naive?
Again, I can only be sorry that most of these kids wear kippah, and the secular, the real secular in Israel, lost it. I mean, they think this is a religious holiday. They find it difficult to identify themselves with the groups. I want again to mention my late father. After the Six Days War, they founded the movement for the whole land of Israel, Eretz Yisrael HaShlema, the movement for Eretz Yisrael HaShlema. And 90% of them were secular, they didn't wear kippah. They were left-wing, the socialists, the Tabenkins, and all the writers and the poets of Israel at that time, Alterman, and Agnon, and Hazaz, and Chaim Guri, and the greatest of the writers and the poets. At that time, the connection to the Bible, the connection to our history, was so deep in the hearts of all these people. It took another generation for people who were not educated properly, who don't know the very basics of their history of the Bible, that sometimes they'll question why we are here and what are we doing here and why. And this must lead to questions, if this the conflict between the Israelis and the Arabs is about a piece of land, let's share the land and bring peace to this world. They don't realize that this is a religious war from the Arab point of view and from the Jewish point of view, because the land of Israel is not a tool to create a shelter for the Jewish people, but a value on its own. It should be one of the main targets of Zionism, not only to get all the Jews out of the diaspora, but to liberate the land of Israel. And if you don't regard the land of Israel as a tool but as a value, then you won't be misguided by trying to trade it and to give it to the Arabs in a hope that this will bring peace to the area.
Well, Benjamin Netanyahu, our prime minister, you know, said that this is our land, and he says we're not foreign occupiers, and he talked about a united Jerusalem, and every time he made these points, he got the big standing ovations. And yet at the same time, he kept alive the idea of two states for two peoples. And he also said something that I you know, caught later on, which is that he said that these people deserve a state so that they can live in dignity, as though living in Israel is undignified in some way for Arabs. And I really thought that this is part of an Islamic rhetoric which really shouldn't have made it into his speech. There's nothing undignified about living in Israel for Arabs. But the point is that he is keeping alive a certain duality, which is really heating up the international scene, heating up the pressure on Israel, because on the one hand, while we still claim that it's our land, we claim that we believe that they have a right, that Arabs have a right to sovereignty on our land. How did you feel when you were watching the Netanyahu speech? Did you, on the one hand, feel some kind of comfort that he was out there, you know, making our case, or were you just disappointed at the fact that he kept those ideas alive of giving away our land?
I mean, you can take one achievement of Benjamin Netanyahu in the Congress, a very clear red line was drawn on that day, and President Obama knows that he cannot cross it, and he cannot do all the evil things that he wants to do to the people of Israel, because the Congress will be with us and will not allow him. And that enforced President Obama to declare that he will have to veto any attempt to accept a Palestinian state as a member state to the United Nations. I'm sure he didn't want to, but he understands that if he needs to have any bills passed in the Congress, he needs the Congress, and he can't go against Israel as he wanted to go to start with. And that's a great achievement of Benjamin Netanyahu. But the beautiful part that he expressed himself, but as the Jewish people cannot be an occupier in our father's land, it's beautiful. But immediately after that, it was found as a fake, because if this is the land of our fathers, this is our homeland, our patria, how can one trade his homeland? It's like saying, this is my mother, I'm ready to share it with somebody else, I'm ready to sell it. That's a fake. And I'm afraid that everybody will pinpoint him on this. If this is really your land, no Brit or Russian or Greek will ever be ready to trade his homeland. If this is really your homeland, as you said, the land of our fathers, how dare you to give it to our enemies?
So here we are. We find ourselves exactly at this point where our prime minister, on the one hand, makes these great statements. On the other hand, keeps these foreign bad ideas alive. What's kind of the next step? Where are we going? Here comes the summer, and summer has been classically the time for war here in the Middle East. Are you foreshadowing a time of warfare this coming summer? Or do you think that the jihad is going to continue to use politics against us? What is the next kind of, the game in town is prediction. What is your prediction for the future? Near future, that is.
I think that the Palestinians have already started to step down from their ambition to have September as the turning point of the international acceptance of a Palestinian state as a member state to the United Nations, and then applying sanctions over Israel by the Security Council if we will not stop building in the settlements, if we will not withdraw from Judea and Samaria. I think they realize that they can't achieve it, and they will look for ways to step down from it. If they will only be recognized by 150 or 160 states, this was already done in 88, and nothing is new and nothing will happen following that. But if they will build up a high level of expectations that something messianic from their point of view will happen in September, we may end up in another round of armed conflict, bloodbath, as always, will push them back. I think that Abu Mazen realized that if he will eventually have a violent conflict with Israel, then he will be pushed aside because nobody will need him for that. They know that the Hamas is much better on this type of conflict, and it will make life easier for Israel to show that, well, these are our enemies, not the one with the suit, with the good English, and with the support of the West, like Salam Fayyad, his prime minister, or himself, that they are accepted as non-violent leaders of the Palestinians. If in September or later in November, if they will have elections, they will be pushed aside and the Hamas will be in power, it is better to have a clear-cut enemy than an enemy in disguise of a nice guy who wear a tie and some academic degree, but has nothing to do with peace or any kind of arrangement, of a non-violent arrangement in Israel, I think that even if we will have another eruption of violence in the Middle East toward autumn, it will be for the good for the state of Israel and not for the bad.
And we are speaking with Knesset member Dr. Aryeh Eldad, and you are listening to Galei Israel, Yishai Fleischer show. And Dr. Aryeh Eldad, you spoke about the suit folks, and you said, you know, they might come to some messianic expectation that may lead to violence. The messianic expectation folks and the jihad front is the Iranians and the Shiite regime that they've established there. They're the wild card, because you don't really know what they're going to do. And they do have violence at their fingertips right now, in the form of the rocketeering from Gaza and the 50,000 rockets that are today in the hands of Hezbollah. That's what really concerns me, and I wanted to ask you what you think about the Iranian summer.
I think it's too early for Iran to start a overt war with Israel right now. They hope to postpone it until they will have nuclear weapon, and they can run it under the umbrella of nuclear weapon, which we must stop before that. But they may try to look for some local explosion from Lebanon or from Gaza, if it will serve their needs. Sometimes they will need it to divert some external pressure, or sometimes they will need it in order to take the attention out of some internal frictions that they will have if the people in Tehran will follow the pattern of the demonstrators last year or 2 years before that, or those in El Tahrir Square in Cairo, or those in Damascus. They will need desperately some diversion in order to take the attention off the back. So we may expect Iranian input in order to raise the tension in this part, and we mustn't let them off the hook. If this happened, we must use this opportunity to destroy the infrastructure of the nuclear industry. That is an achievable goal. We can do that. We can postpone the nuclear weapon for 5 years, for another 10 years or so, and this will give us enough time to change Iran to a state that is not looking for a mass destruction weapon against Israel.
Where is Israel when it comes to the Iranian people and the Syrian people? You know, I'm seeing right now these regimes, these tyrants, exposing themselves for the murderous, villainous, tyrannical, and despotic regimes that they are. And I think that we're sitting on the sidelines and not saying enough, saying we stand with the people of Syria for freedom. We stand with the people of Iran against this mullah regime. Where is Israel when it comes to this moment?
I think it would be a mistake, because the last thing the opponents of the regime in Iran needs is an Israeli hug. Or once we say that we support the demonstrator in Syria, then it will be very easy for Bashar al-Assad to tell the world, and most important, his people, look, do you see? These are Israeli agents. They work for Israel. That's why Israel hug and kiss them, bless them. Maybe they send them arms. Maybe they try to undermine the regime in Damascus through the demonstrators. I've learned the lesson in Lebanon, when we try to support a Christian against the Palestinians in 82, in the first Lebanese war. Eventually, we actually sentence the Lebanese president to death by in the hands of the Syrian, because once we are too close to any candidate, even if we think that he will be eventually good for us, we shouldn't, at least not publicly, support him, hug him, give him money or weapons, because this will immediately sentence him to death.
I was happy, though, that the Prime Minister of Israel did mention that Israel stands in essence, with freedoms in the Middle East.
Yes, even President Obama said so. So what? It's a hypocritic declaration, because when the United States attack Libya, they do not do the same thing in Syria or in Tehran. So it's on the declarative side, it's very nice, but once Israel is really trying to intervene in Syria, it won't be for the good of the demonstrators.
I just want the people of the Middle East to realize that Israel is the answer and not the problem. And I think that that's coming out with the Tahrir Square, the fact that the Arab regimes that are causing joblessness, despotically ruling the people, putting them in secret prisons and torturing them, that the way Israel, that what Israel has to offer in the Middle East is the better way. And I just want us to say that instead of just being kind of saying, you know, let us just live, just recognize us as a Jewish state. That's all we want here. It's like, no, actually, we have a light unto the nation's mission here. We actually want to make a better Middle East. And Israel is the answer, not the problem.
Yes, for too long, Israel was the ultimate excuse for any wrong in the Middle East. Anything bad that happened to the people in the Middle East, we were excused. We were blamed, and today, when they killed another 100 of demonstrators in Syria, when the United Nations started to press them, big things happened in Syria. Do you know what was the most important thing today for Syrian hackers to do today?
No.
They broke in into my site, into my internet site, and put their slogans in it, declaring that one day the whole land of Israel will be Syrian, because this is part of Syria, and they put the Syrian flag in it. It is again clear-cut. Hired people by the regime as those demonstrators who tried to invade Israel 2 weeks ago, and last week when they broke near Majd al-Shams in the northern border. It's almost a desperate attempt to take the attention out of what goes on in the streets of Damascus and Hama and Daraa and Marj al-Shura and all these places where they kill masses of Syrian citizens, try to remind the people of the old problem. Remember Israel, remember Palestine. This is our enemy. I think the good news about what goes on now in the Middle East is people do not buy it anymore.
Knesset member Ariel Dad, I want to thank you and wish you continued success. I hope you don't have to deal with too many more burn victims. And I hope that our Knesset is going to keep moving strong to help this country become more proudly Jewish, more proudly Israeli, and be a light unto the Middle East and the nations of the world. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Ishai, and big success in your new show. It's important to all of us.
Toda rabah. Thank you again.
Bye-bye.
All right, folks, you are listening to Yishai Fleischer on Galei Yisrael. It is so cool to be broadcasting here to you today. And throughout the world, you can listen to this podcast. It's going to be on YishaiFleischer.com. And my email address is Yishai@YishaiFleischer.com. Now, I want to tell you about something that's been happening to me lately. You know, I got a lot of work. I moved to Jerusalem. It's very exciting. I'm doing TV. I'm doing radio. I have an organization called Kuma. Kuma means arise. And the idea of arise is to get Israel to be more Jewish, more Israeli, actually. I like the term Israeli even better. The idea of Kuma is to make Israel more Israeli, more proud of its national character. Judaism is the thing that informs that Israeli character. But really being an Israeli, something so inclusive, so organic, so holistic. And Kuma is there to help us get back into that, to fall in love with being Jewish, as we talked about in the beginning of the program. Part of that, of course, is American Aliyah, North American Aliyah, World Aliyah. I had a guy in my car today, a young Frenchman, and he was telling me about his parents being stuck over there. They want to move here to Israel. We talked about French Aliyah. There's about 600,000 Jews there. We got Russian Aliyah. We got maybe a million Jews still left in Russia. We got American Jews, North American Jews, who are some of the toughest nuts to crack when it comes to Aliyah, because they have it really good in a great country, America. But that's the trick of America, right? The trick of America is that it's really good. People say to me, watch out, there's going to be anti-Semitism there one day. I say, listen, anti-Semitism in America would be a welcome change, because what we have right now is an unbelievably powerful philo-Semitism, a love of the Jews, which is killing us way faster. We fall to the assimilation problem much faster than we do to anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism reminds us that we're Jewish, but philo-Semitism makes us forget. That's why the Moabite women were used by Moab to entice Jewish men in biblical times, and it worked much better than did, you know, hateful anti-Semitic acts, which strengthen us inside. So the trick of America is philo-Semitism. So Kuma, my organization, has been working extremely hard to get people into the consciousness of falling in love with Israeli Jewish culture again, with authentic Hebrewness. And we work very hard to make American Jews, North American Jews, wake up to the fact that we have a homeland that we're building and we could be part of it. So you got that. You know, I got a wonderful wife, a wonderful daughter. I just moved to Jerusalem, which costs me at least 10 times more than my life in Beit El. And so a lot of stress amasses. What do you do with a lot of stress? How do you deal with a lot of stress? I have a new solution. It's called jogging in East Jerusalem. Yes, that sounds kind of stressful itself, jogging around Eastern Jerusalem. It does sound a little stressful, and it kind of is, but, you know, at least you're out there running, and sometimes you got to run a little bit even faster, but you're running around Jewish graves from 2,000-3,000 years ago. You got the graves of Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. You got, Arabs. Some are friendly, others not. You got the old city walls. You got the Temple Mount. You got this big golden mosque on it. Is it pretty? Is it ugly? What does it mean to me? So you're running in East Jerusalem and you're sweating and you're letting yourself go a little bit. You're listening to something useful in your ears and you're sweating and you're sweating. And I am a big believer in sweating. Right now in this very recording room, I'm sweating because the air conditioner is off. But sweating in the land of Israel, running it, is the way to actually throw off a little bit of stress. If I don't run for a few days, it gets me depressed. It gets me sad. And I highly recommend physical activity for stress relief. And one of the big challenges of Israel is not to just live with that stress all the time. It's actually somehow also, you know, taking a moment to breathe, to enjoy. And also even on Shabbat, you know, it's our time to relax, but yet we always have a lot of guests, a lot of people are coming in. It's important to know how to relax. And the beauty about the land of Israel is that it's got many vacation spots. One of the best vacation spots is in the north right now, where there's going to be berry picking. There's going to be great. Did you know that there's blueberries in Israel? I did not know it. So I'm really planning on taking my family up for a little bit of berry picking out there and maybe get to the beach. We have four different beaches here in Israel, right? Four different kinds of beaches. We have this big lake called the Kinneret, the Sea of the Galilee, which you must be familiar with. We have the Red Sea, this deep water port in the Red Sea, cold, beautiful, sparkling water with crazy fish and coral reefs. We have the Mediterranean, this big bowl of soup. It's nice and warm and sweet and good. I just love it. And we have the Dead Sea, which is really the most unique thing that we have. One of the most unique things in the world. You know, God, what he did was when he flipped over Sodom and Amorah, Sodom and Gomorrah, you know what he did? He made the world's biggest natural spa. He made a big, healthy place to hang out. And so if you're listening to this program and you're getting a little stressed out, let's do a little exercise. Let's take a deep breath a little bit. Let's relax. My friends in Israel and across the world, let's relax a little bit. Let's enjoy being alive. And let's just, for 1 second, just say, I can't believe how lucky I am that I'm alive. There's so many people that are less lucky and less fortunate than I. All I have to do is just go to the hospital or think about the people that are in the intensive care ward right now, and I'll know that I'm very, very lucky. And for those people who are in the intensive care ward, let us pray. Let us have a little bit of a prayer for a minute. Let's say, please, God, heal the people of Israel. Heal the people around the world. And I especially want to send out a very special healing hug and blessing and prayer to my friend Eliezer Chaim Ben Zelda Tzipora, who's very ill and fighting for his life. And I just can't believe the courage of this man to constantly see the good and see the possibility to get healed and to visualize himself as a healthy man. And he's fighting cancer on many fronts. And I just want to believe with all my heart that Eliezer Chaim Ben Zelda Tzipora is going to be 100% well. And I want to pray for a lot of people, people who have sick children, whose heart is broken, who have to quit their jobs just to heal their kids. I want to pray for all those people. I want to give you guys strength. I want you to know that we're thinking about you and that we're not all selfish. You know, this world is designed to be a selfish place. You got to just pray just to make it today. It's so tough to make it. And yet somehow we can't be selfish. We have to be about other people. And when we are about other people, when we have that chesed, when we have that chesed in our hearts, that kindness, when we actually take from this world and take a break from this world's demands on us and focus it on other people, then we're doing what we're supposed to be doing as human beings. And that's not always easy, you know? The more I grow up, the more I realize I actually need to be a little bit selfish to make it, you know, just to make it every single day. And then I say to myself, no, that can't be right. That can't be right, you know? With all that, if you're just trying to make it, you didn't do much. So you kind of got yourself successful, got yourself alive. But in the end of the day, God could take that success away. He is really in charge of our success. And I think that part of giving chesed and love to others is having one of the most important characteristics in Judaism, which is faith, bitachon, real confidence in God, that he is the supporter, that no matter how much money you want, he's already set out exactly how much money you're going to get. You're not going to get a penny more. And he's going to take care of you every single day. He's going to give you that ability to make your life whatever you need. He's going to give it to you. He's not going to give you one penny more than you need and not one penny less. But actually, there is a way you could get less, is that if you're faulty, if you're bad, recalcitrant, and weak about one very special commandment, which is to have faith in God, because faith is the channel. Faith is the conduit. Faith is the vessel that will actually get you what you need. If you believe in God and you say, hey, there's nobody else to turn to. There's no boss. There's no efforts. There's nothing that I could do that would be outside the realm of you. You're everything. And if you can plug into that consciousness of having one God, and his godliness being one, meaning to say that, yes, of course there's one God. Everybody understands there's not 10 gods. But do you know that everything around you, that is God? He is really the provider. If you can strengthen that feeling inside of yourself, that really Hashem is everywhere, and that he's in everything, and that those little screw-ups in your life are there in order to teach you. Just a few minutes ago, I was trying to record on this board, and I couldn't find the right button until the great engineer, my friend Elad, came in, and he showed me, and you know what? I've learned it for life, where the button is that gets it to work. So God gave me a teaching. He learned me. He taught me. And you know what? Now I feel a little bit better. But you know, at that moment, I wanted to freak out. I wanted to say, where's my engineer? Why doesn't this work? Where's the button? What's wrong? And then I took a little breath and I said, you know what? I got to have faith that there's a moment here that's happening. I don't need to get stressed out. I don't need to have what I call in my house, insta sweat, which I just freak out because, you know, something is not going right. Guys and gals, we got to take a step back. And we got to be extremely, extremely thankful for every moment in our life. And we have to have a lot more positivity than we do. And we have to not flip out at our spouses or at the people on the road or at the guard that's doing an extra check. Don't flip out about that. Be thankful. If we would slow down our life a little bit, be a little more thankful, that would help us deal with stress. And as I'm talking to you, I hear myself talking to me because I know that I'm a victim. Yes, I'm a victim of stress. And because that's because I want to get a lot done in this world, because this world is a short period of time. And the greatest real estate in this world is time, because you can never get that moment back, that moment that you missed. You can lose $1 million and make it back again, but you can't get another second back. And the richest person in the world cannot get that second back. So time, ladies and gentlemen, is the most valuable property there is. And once you start getting into that consciousness, you want to make every single moment in your life as successful and as meaningful and as useful as possible. But that thinking also gets you stressed, because you don't want to miss out and you want things to go right. And that's when a little bit of also, while you have that sense that you want to achieve and you want to milk every moment, at the same time, there's a place to breathe and to relax. So today, I had an opportunity. I was in one part of Jerusalem, and I had to meet my wife in a different part. I could have taken a bus. I could have taken a cab. But you know what I did? I walked for an hour and 45 minutes. Granted, I had my cell phone with me, which was basically a little computer. So I was firing off emails, and I was making phone calls, and I was doing everything. But I was also breathing and walking. And in between phone calls, I looked around, and I said, how beautiful is Jerusalem? How beautiful is this life? How beautiful are the opportunities that we have granted? And the whole day through, I was thinking that I was going to be with you here on Galei Yisrael, which is just so amazing to be broadcasting. I love to say these numbers that Galei Yisrael is broadcasting on in the south, my good friends in the south of Israel, 102.5. 102.5 Badaom, 102.5 in the south. 106.5 Bemerkaz in central Israel, 106.5. 89.3 Beirushalayim, and in Jerusalem, our heart and our capital, our greatest dream, our greatest yearning, it's 89.3. And God says, He will not come into the upper Jerusalem until he comes into the lower Jerusalem. And that's what's happening right now. You, my listeners, are coming up to the lower Jerusalem and building it. North American Jews, French Jews, Russian Jews, every kind of Jews are coming to build this country, to build that lower domain for God, for the Jewish people, for authentic Jewish culture. And big things are happening in the skies as well. So don't be afraid. Have a ton of bitachon, real faith in God, real faith. Strengthen that channel and that conduit. Strengthen yourself as a vessel. Things are going to go good for you. And don't get stressed. Stress just weakens those elements, those arteries of blessing, those channels of blessing. And so do yourself a favor. Try to keep it real, man. You know when to be spiritual, know when to talk to God, and know when also to relax yourself, to take a deep breath and enjoy life. And take a moment and examine that fruit before you just stuff it down your face. And just say, thank you, God, for this banana. Wow. And then when you eat that banana, this is a sin that I always fall in. I don't take time to chew that banana and taste that banana. Take the time. Eat that banana with joy. Love that banana. Say, God, this is a good banana. Gosh, this is a sweet life. And those moments of sweetness are going to be remembered for you as when you really had a deep and conscious moment in this world. And then if you could also take another banana and give it to your friend and say, here you might go, my brother, here's a banana. Love your brother. Give him a lot of love. Give him a lot of hugs. Your sister as well. There's a lot of good to share. And when it comes to the land of Israel, to be positive, to realize that it all comes together here, the banana and the positive feeling and the faith in God and the fearlessness and the struggle to make every moment meaningful, but at the same time knowing how to stay cool and enjoy life, that is the way to do it right. And with that, my friends, I want to wish you a Laila Tov, a good night. I hope that you enjoyed being with me on the program. I know I enjoyed being with you, that's for sure. Woo! It's hot and sweaty out there in the world. They throw mud at you. You got to throw some back. You got to know when to duck. You got to know when not to care. You got to know when to be alive. And that's always. You are listening to Yishai Fleischer on Galei Yisrael. Maiden voyage begins here. And I hope you'll be with me. My email address is Yishai, Y-I-S-H-A-I, at YishaiFleischer.com. No C, please. Keep the C for yourself. But for me, Yishai Fleischer, no C. I look forward to your emails. I look forward to being with you again here on Galei Israel next Tuesday night, midnight to 2 Israel time, and around the world, wherever you are. Keep it real, baby. Keep it Israel. More great stuff is on the way on Galei Israel, so stay tuned. Shalom.